moved his hand to his gun vigilantly. "No, I'm not blaming you," said Havermeyer, "even though I don't like you. You know, I'm not too happy about flying so many missions anymore, either. Isn't there some way I can get out of it, too?" Yossarian snickered ironically and joked, "Put a gun on and start marching with me." Havermeyer shook his head thoughtfully. "No, I couldn't do that. I might bring some disgrace on my wife and kid if I acted like a coward. Nobody likes a coward. Besides, I want to stay in the reserves when the war is over. You get $500 a year if you stay in the reserves."
"Then fly more missions."
"Yeah, I guess I have to. Say, do you think there's any chance they might take you off combat duty and send you home?"
"No."
"But if they do and let you take one person with you, will you pick me? Don't pick anyone like Appleby. Pick me."
"Why in the world should they do something like that?"
"I don't know, but if they do, just remember that I asked you first, will you? And let me know how you're doing. I'll wait for you here in these bushes every night. Maybe if they don't do anything bad to you, I won't fly any more missions either. Okay?" All the next evening, people kept popping up at him out of the darkness to ask him how he was doing, appealing to him for confidential information with weary, troubled faces on the basis of some morbid and clandestine kinship he had not guessed existed. People in the squadron he barely knew popped into sight out of nowhere as he passed and asked him how he was doing. Even men from other squadrons came one by one to conceal themselves in the darkness and pop out. Everywhere he stepped after sundown, someone was lying in wait to pop out and ask him how he was doing. People popped out at him from trees and bushes, from ditches and tall weeds, from around the corners of tents, and from behind the fenders of parked cars. Even one of his roommates popped out to ask him how he was doing and pleaded with him not to tell any of his other roommates he had popped out. Yossarian drew near each beckoning, overly cautious silhouette, with his hand on his gun, never knowing which hissing shadow would finally turn dishonestly into Natalie's whore, or worse, into some duly constituted governmental authority sent to club him ruthlessly into insensibility. It began to look as if they would have to do something like that. They did not want to court-martial him for desertion in the face of the enemy, because 135 miles away from the enemy could hardly be called the face of the enemy, and because Yossarian was the one who had finally knocked down the bridge at Ferrara by going around twice over the target and killing Kraft. He was almost forgetting Kraft when he counted the dead men he knew. But they had to do something to him, and everyone waited grimly to see what horrible thing it would be. During the day, they avoided him, even Arfi, and Yossarian understood that there were different people together in daylight than they were alone in the dark. He did not care about them at all as he walked about backward with his hand on his gun and awaited the latest blandishments, threats, and inducements from group each time Captains Pilchard and Wren drove back from another urgent conference with Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn. Hungry Joe was hardly around, and the only other person who ever spoke to him was Captain Black, who called him old blood and guts in a merry, taunting voice each time he hailed him, and who came back from Rome toward the end of the week to tell him Natalie's whore was gone. Yossarian turned sorry with a stab of yearning and remorse. He missed her.
"Gone?"
he echoed in a hollow tone.
"Yeah, gone!"
Captain Black laughed, his bleary eyes narrow with fatigue and his peaked, sharp face sprouting as usual with a sparse, reddish-blonde stubble. He rubbed the bags under his eyes with both fists.
"I thought I might as well give this stupid broad another boff just for old time's sake, as long as I was in Rome, anyway. You know, just to keep that kid Natalie's body spinning in his grave. Remember the way I used to needle him? But the place was empty. Was there any word from her?"
prodded Yossarian, who had been brooding incessantly about the girl, wondering how much she was suffering and feeling almost lonely and deserted without her ferocious and unappeasable attacks.
"There's no one there,"
Captain Black exclaimed cheerfully, trying to make Yossarian understand.
"Don't you understand? They're all gone. The whole place is busted.
Gone?
Yeah, gone. Flushed right out into the street. Captain Black chuckled heartily again, and his pointed Adam's apple jumped up and down with glee inside his scraggly neck. The joint's empty. The MPs busted the whole apartment up and drove the whores right out. Ain't that a laugh?
Yusarian was scared and began to tremble.
Why'd they do that?
What difference does it make? Responded Captain Black with an exuberant gesture. They flushed him right out into the street. Like that. The whole batch.
What about the kid's sister?
Flushed away, laughed Captain Black. Flushed away with the rest of the broads, right out into the street.
But she's only a kid,
Yosarian objected passionately.
She doesn't know anybody else in the whole city.
What's going to happen to her?
What the hell do I care,
responded Captain Black with an indifferent shrug, and then gawked suddenly at Yosarian with surprise and with a crafty gleam of prying elation.
Say, what's the matter? If I knew this was going to make you so unhappy, I would have come right over and told you just to make you eat your liver. Hey, where are you going? Come on back. Come on back here and eat your liver.
39. The Eternal City. Yosarian was going absent without official leave with Milo, who, as the plane cruised toward Rome, shook his head reproachfully, and with pious lips pursed, informed Yosarian in ecclesiastical tones that he was ashamed of him. Yosarian nodded. Yosarian was making an uncouth spectacle of himself by walking around backward with his gun on his hip and refusing to fly more combat missions, Milo said. Yosarian nodded. It was disloyal to his squadron and embarrassing to his superiors. He was placing Milo in a very uncomfortable position, too. Yosarian nodded again. The men were starting to grumble. It was not fair for Yosarian to think only of his own safety while men like Milo, Colonel Cathcart, Colonel Korn, and ex-PFC Wintergreen were willing to do everything they could to win the war. The men with 70 missions were starting to grumble because they had to fly 80, and there was a danger some of them might put on guns and begin walking around backward, too. Morale was deteriorating, and it was all Yosarian's fault. The country was in peril. He was jeopardizing his traditional rights of freedom and independence by daring to exercise them. Yosarian kept nodding in the co-pilot seat and tried not to listen as Milo prattled on. Natalie's whore was on his mind, as were Kraft and Orr and Natalie and Dunbar and Kid Sampson and McWatt and all the poor and stupid and diseased people he had seen in Italy, Egypt, and North Africa and knew about in other areas of the world. And Snowden and Natalie's whore's kid sister were on his conscience, too. Yosarian thought he knew why Natalie's whore held him responsible for Natalie's death and wanted to kill him. Why the hell shouldn't she? It was a man's world, and she and everyone younger had every right to blame him and everyone older for every unnatural tragedy that befell them, just as she, even in her grief, was to blame for every man-made misery that landed on her kid sister and on all other children behind her. Someone had to do something sometime. Every victim was a culprit, every culprit a victim. And somebody had to stand up sometime to try to break the lousy chain of inherited habit that was imperiling them all. In parts of Africa, little boys were still stolen away by adult slave traders and sold for money to men who disemboweled them and ate them. Yosarian marveled that children could suffer such barbaric sacrifice without evincing the slightest hint of fear or pain. He took it for granted that they did submit so stoically. If not, he reasoned, the custom would certainly have died, for no craving for wealth or immortality could be so great, he felt, as to subsist on the sorrow of children. He was rocking the boat, Milo said, And Yossarian nodded once more. He was not a good member of the team, Milo said. Yossarian nodded, and listened to Milo tell him that the decent thing to do, if he did not like the way Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn were running the group, was to go to Russia, instead of stirring up trouble. Yossarian refrained from pointing out that Colonel Cathcart, Colonel Korn, and Milo could all go to Russia if they did not like the way he was stirring up trouble. Colonel Cathcart and Colonel Korn had both been very good to Yossarian, Milo said. Hadn't they given him a medal after the last mission to Ferrara and promoted him to captain? Yossarian nodded. Didn't they feed him and give him his pay every month? Yossarian nodded again. Milo was sure they would be charitable if he went to them to apologize and recant and promise to fly 80 missions. Yossarian said he would think it over and held his breath and prayed for a safe landing as Milo dropped his wheels and glided in toward the runway. It was funny how he had really come to detest flying. Rome was in ruins, he saw when the plane was down. The aerodrome had been bombed 8 months before, and knobby slabs of white stone rubble had been bulldozed into flat-topped heaps on both sides of the entrance through the wire fence surrounding the field. The Colosseum was a dilapidated shell, and the Arch of Constantine had fallen. Natalie's whore's apartment was a shambles. The girls were gone, and the only one there was the old woman. The windows in the apartment had been smashed. She was bundled up in sweaters and skirts and wore a dark shawl about her head. She sat on a wooden chair near an electric hot plate, her arms folded boiling water in a battered aluminum pot. She was talking aloud to herself when Yossarian entered and began moaning as soon as she saw him.
"Gone,"
she moaned before he could even inquire. Holding her elbow, she rocked back and forth mournfully on her creaking chair.
"Gone."
"Who?"
"All. All the poor young girls."
"Where?"
"Away. Chased away into the street. All of them gone. All the poor young girls."
"Chased away by who? Who did it?"
"The mean, tall soldiers with the hard white hats and clubs. And by our carabinieri, they came with their clubs and chased them away. They would not even let them take their coats. The poor things, that just chased them away into the cold."
"Did they arrest them?"
"They chased them away. They just chased them away."
"Then why did they do it if they didn't arrest them?"
"I don't know," sobbed the old woman. "I don't know. Who will take care of me? Who will take care of me now that all of the poor young girls are gone? Who will take care of me?"
"There must have been a reason," Yossarian persisted, pounding his fist into his hand. "They couldn't just barge in here and chase everyone out."
"No reason," wailed the old woman. "No reason."
"What right did they have?"
"Catch it 22.
"What?" Yossarian froze in his tracks with fear and alarm and felt his whole body begin to tingle. "What did you say?"
"Catch 22,
the old woman repeated, rocking her head up and down.
"Catch 22. Catch 22 says they have a right to do anything we can stop them from doing."
"What the hell are you talking about?" Yossarian shouted at her in bewildered, furious protest. "How did you know it was Catch 22? Who the hell told you it was Catch 22?
"The soldiers with the hard white hats and the clubs. The girls were crying. Did we do anything wrong?" They said.
The men said no, and they pushed them away out of the door with the ends of their clubs.
"Then why are you chasing us out?" the girl said. "Catch 22, the man said. "What right do you have?" the girl said. "Catch 22, the man said. All they kept saying was, "Catch 22, catch 22. What does it mean, catch 22? What is a catch 22?
"Didn't they show it to you?" Yossarian demanded, stamping about in anger and distress. Didn't you make them read it?
They don't have to show us Catch-22, the old woman answered. The law says they don't have to.
What law says they don't have to?
Catch-22.
Oh, God damn, Yossarian exclaimed bitterly. I bet it wasn't even really there.
He stopped walking and glanced about the room disconsolately.
Where's the old man?
Gone,
mourned the old woman.
Gone?
Dead,
the old woman told him, nodding in emphatic lament, pointing to her head with the flat of her hand.
Something broke in here. One minute he was living, one minute he was dead.
But he can't be dead,
Yossarian cried, ready to argue insistently. But of course he knew it was true, knew it was logical and true. Once again, the old man had marched along with the majority. Yossarian turned away and trudged through the apartment with a gloomy scowl, peering with pessimistic curiosity into all the rooms. Everything made of glass had been smashed by the men with the clubs. Torn drapes and bedding lay dumped on the floor. Chairs, tables, and dressers had been overturned. Everything breakable had been broken. The destruction was total. No wild vandals could have been more thorough. Every window was smashed, and darkness poured like inky clouds into each room through the shattered panes. Yossarian could imagine the heavy crashing footfalls of the tall MPs in the hard white hats. He could picture the fiery and malicious exhilaration with which they had made their wreckage, and their sanctimonious, ruthless sense of right and dedication. All the poor young girls were gone. Everyone was gone, but the weeping old woman in the bulky brown and gray sweaters and black head shawl. And soon, she, too, would be gone.
Gone,
she grieved when he walked back in before he could even speak.
Who will take care of me now?
Yossarian ignored the question.
Knightley's girlfriend, did anyone hear from her?
He asked.
Gone.
I know she's gone, but did anyone hear from her? Does anyone know where she is?
Gone.
The little sister. What happened to her?
Gone.
The old woman's tone had not changed.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yossarian asked sharply, staring into her eyes to see if she were not speaking to him from a coma. He raised his voice.
What happened to the kid's sister, to the little girl?
Gone, gone.
The old woman replied with a crabby shrug, irritated by his persistence, her low wail growing louder.
Chased away with the rest! Chased away into the street! They would not even let her take her coat!
Where did she go?
I don't know! I don't know!
Who will take care of her?
Who will take care of me?
She doesn't know anybody else, does she?
Who will take care of me?
Yossarian left money in the old woman's lap. It was odd how many wrongs leaving money seemed to right, and strode out of the apartment, cursing Catch-22 vehemently as he descended the stairs, even though he knew there was no such thing. Catch-22 did not exist. He was positive of that, but it made no difference. What did matter was that everyone thought it existed, and that was much worse. For there was no object or text to ridicule or refute, to accuse, criticize, attack, amend, hate, revile, spit at, rip to shreds, trample upon, or burn up. It was cold outside, and dark, and a leaky, insipid mist lay swollen in the air and trickled down the large, unpolished stone blocks of the houses and the pedestals of monuments. Yossarian hurried back to Milo and recanted. He said he was sorry, and knowing he was lying, promised to fly as many more missions as Colonel Cathcart wanted if Milo would only use all his influence in Rome to help him locate Knightley's whore's kid sister.
She's just a 12-year-old virgin, Milo, he explained anxiously, and I want to find her before it's too late.
Milo responded to his request with a benign smile.
I've got just the 12-year-old virgin you're looking for, he announced jubilantly.
This 12-year-old virgin is really only 34. But she was brought up on a low-protein diet by very strict parents and didn't start sleeping with men until...
Milo, I'm talking about a little girl!
Yossarian interrupted him with desperate impatience. Don't you understand? I don't want to sleep with her. I want to help her. You've got daughters. She's just a little kid, and she's all alone in this city with no one to take care of her. I want to protect her from harm. Don't you know what I'm talking about? Milo did understand and was deeply touched. Yossarian, I'm proud of you, he exclaimed with profound emotion. I really am. You don't know how glad I am to see that everything isn't always just sex with you. You've got principles. Certainly, I've got daughters, and I know exactly what you're talking about. We'll find that girl. Don't you worry. You come with me, and we'll find that girl if we have to turn this whole city upside down. Come along.
Yossarian went along in Milo Minderbinder's speeding M&M staff car to police headquarters to meet a swarthy, untidy police commissioner with a narrow black mustache and unbuttoned tunic who was fiddling with a stout woman with warts and two chins when they entered his office, and who greeted Milo with warm surprise and bowed and scraped in obscene servility as though Milo were some elegant marquis.
Ah, Marchese Milo, he declared with effusive pleasure, pushing the fat, disgruntled woman out the door without even looking toward her. Why didn't you tell me you were coming? I would have a big party for you. Come in, Marchese. You almost never visit us anymore.
Milo knew that there was not one moment to waste.
Hello, Luigi, he said, nodding so briskly that he almost seemed rude. Luigi, I need your help. My friend here wants to find a girl.
A girl, Marchese, said Luigi, scratching his face pensively. There are lots of girls in Rome. For an American officer, a girl should not be too difficult.
No, Luigi, you don't understand. This is a 12-year-old virgin that he has to find right away.
Yes. Now I understand, Luigi said sagaciously. The virgin might take a little time, but if he waits at the bus terminal, where the young farm girls looking for work arrive, I...
Luigi, you still don't understand, Milo snapped with such brusque impatience that the police commissioner's face flushed, and he jumped to attention and began buttoning his uniform in confusion. This girl is a friend, an old friend of the family, and we want to help her. She's only a child. She's all alone in the city somewhere, and we have to find her before somebody harms her. Now do you understand? Luigi, this is very important to me. I have a daughter the same age as that little girl, and nothing in the world means more to me right now than saving that poor child before it's too late. Will you help?
Si, Marquette. Now I understand, said Luigi, and I will do everything in my power to find her. But tonight I have almost no men. Tonight all of my men are busy trying to break up the traffic in illegal tobacco.
Illegal tobacco? Asked Milo.
Milo,
Yossarian bleated faintly with a sinking heart, sensing at once that all was lost.
Si, Marchese, said Luigi. The profit in illegal tobacco is so high that the smuggling is almost impossible to control.
Is there really that much profit in illegal tobacco?
Milo inquired with keen interest, his rust-colored eyebrows arching avidly and his nostrils sniffing.
Milo! Yossarian called to him. Pay attention to me, will you? Si, Marchese, Luigi answered. The profit in illegal tobacco is very high. The smuggling is a national scandal, Marchese, truly a national disgrace.
Is that a fact?
Milo observed with a preoccupied smile and started toward the door as though in a spell.
Milo!
Yossarian yelled and bounded forward impulsively to intercept him.
Milo, you've got to help me!
Illegal tobacco, Milo explained to him with a look of epileptic lust, struggling doggedly to get by.
Let me go. I've got to smuggle illegal tobacco.
Stay here and help me find her, pleaded Yossarian. You can smuggle illegal tobacco tomorrow.
But Milo was deaf and kept pushing forward, nonviolently but irresistibly, sweating, his eyes as though he were in the grip of a blind fixation, burning feverishly, and his twitching mouth slavering. He moaned calmly as though in remote, instinctive distress, and kept repeating, "Illegal tobacco. Illegal tobacco." Yossarian stepped out of the way with resignation, finally, when he saw it was hopeless to try to reason with him. Milo was gone like a shot. The commissioner of police unbuttoned his tunic again and looked at Yossarian with contempt.
"What do you want here?" he asked coldly. "Do you want me to arrest you?"
Yossarian walked out of the office and down the stairs into the dark, tomb-like street, passing in the hall the stout woman with warts and two chins who was already on her way back in. There was no sign of Milo outside. There were no lights in any of the windows. The deserted sidewalk rose steeply and continuously for several blocks. He could see the glare of a broad avenue at the top of the long cobblestone incline. The police station was almost at the bottom. The yellow bulbs at the entrance sizzled in the dampness like wet torches. A frigid, fine rain was falling. He began walking slowly, pushing uphill. Soon he came to a quiet, cozy, inviting restaurant, with red velvet drapes in the windows and a blue neon sign near the door that said, "Tony's Restaurant. Fine food and drink. Keep out." The words on the blue neon sign surprised him mildly, only for an instant. Nothing warped seemed bizarre anymore in his strange, distorted surroundings. The tops of the sheer buildings slanted in weird, surrealistic perspective, and the street seemed tilted. He raised the collar of his warm woolen coat and hugged it around him. The night was raw. A boy in a thin shirt and thin, tattered trousers walked out of the darkness on bare feet. The boy had black hair and needed a haircut and shoes and socks. His sickly face was pale and sad. His feet made grisly, soft, sucking sounds in the rain puddles on the wet pavement as he passed. And Yossarian was moved by such intense pity for his poverty that he wanted to smash his pale, sad, sickly face with his fist and knock him out of existence, because he brought to mind all the pale, sad, sickly children in Italy that same night who needed haircuts and needed shoes and socks. He made Yossarian think of cripples and of cold and hungry men and women and of all the dumb, passive, devout mothers with catatonic eyes nursing infants outdoors that same night with chilled animal udders bared insensibly to that same raw rain. Cows. Almost on cue, a nursing mother padded past, holding an infant in black rags. And Yossarian wanted to smash her, too, because she reminded him of that barefoot boy in the thin shirt and thin, tattered trousers, and of all the shivering, stupefying misery in a world that never yet had provided enough heat and food and justice for all but an ingenious and unscrupulous handful. What a lousy earth! He wondered how many people were destitute that same night, even in his own prosperous country. How many homes were shanties? How many husbands were drunk and wives socked? And how many children were bullied and abused or abandoned? How many families hungered for food they could not afford to buy? How many hearts were broken? How many suicides would take place that same night? How many people would go insane? How many cockroaches and landlords would triumph? How many winners were losers, successes, failures, rich men, poor men? How many wise guys were stupid? How many happy endings were unhappy endings? how many honest men were liars, brave men, cowards, loyal men, traitors, how many sainted men were corrupt, how many people in positions of trust had sold their souls to blackguards for petty cash, how many had never had souls, how many straight and narrow paths were crooked paths, how many best families were worst families, and how many good people were bad people. When you added them all up and then subtracted, you might be left with only the children, and perhaps with Albert Einstein and an old violinist or sculptor somewhere. Yossarian walked in lonely torture, feeling estranged, and could not wipe from his mind the excruciating image of the barefoot boy with sickly cheeks, until he turned the corner into the avenue finally and came upon an allied soldier having convulsions on the ground, a young lieutenant with a small, pale, boyish face. Six other soldiers from different countries wrestled with different parts of him, striving to help him and hold him still. He yelped and groaned unintelligibly through clenched teeth. His eyes rolled up into his head. "Don't let him bite his tongue off," a short sergeant near Yossarian advised shrewdly, and a seventh man threw himself into the fray to wrestle with the ill lieutenant's face. All at once, the wrestlers won and turned to each other undecidedly, for now that they had held the young lieutenant rigid, they did not know what to do with him. A quiver of moronic panic spread from one straining brute face to another.
"Why don't you lift him up and put him on the hood of that car?"
a corporal standing in back of Yossarian drawled. That seemed to make sense, so the seven men lifted the young lieutenant up and stretched him out carefully on the hood of a parked car, still pinning each struggling part of him down. Once they had him stretched out on the hood of the parked car, they stared at each other uneasily again, for they had no idea what to do with him next.
"Why don't you lift him off the hood of that car and lay him down on the ground?"
drawled the same corporal behind Yossarian. That seemed like a good idea, too, and they began to move him back to the sidewalk. But before they could finish, a jeep raced up with a flashing red spotlight at the side and two military policemen in the front.
"What's going on?" the driver yelled.
"He's having convulsions,"
one of the men grappling with one of the young lieutenant's limbs answered.
"We're holding him still."
"That's good. He's under arrest."
"What should we do with him?"
"Keep him under arrest," the MP shouted, doubling over with raucous laughter at his jest, and sped away in his jeep.
Yossarian recalled that he had no leave papers, and moved prudently past the strange group, toward the sound of muffled voices emanating from a distance inside the murky darkness ahead. The broad, rain-blotched boulevard was illuminated every half-block by short, curling lampposts with eerie, shimmering glares surrounded by smoky brown mist. From a window overhead, he heard an unhappy female voice pleading,
"Please don't! Please don't!"
A despondent young woman in a black raincoat with much black hair on her face passed with her eyes lowered. At the Ministry of Public Affairs on the next block, a drunken lady was backed up against one of the fluted Corinthian columns by a drunken young soldier, while three drunken comrades in arms sat watching nearby on the steps, with wine bottles standing between their legs.
"Please don't," begged the drunken lady. "I want to go home now. Please don't."
One of the three men cursed pugnaciously and hurled a wine bottle down at Yossarian when he turned to look up. The bottle shattered harmlessly far away with a brief and muted noise. Yossarian continued walking away at the same listless, unhurried pace, hands buried in his pockets.
"Come on, baby," he heard the drunken soldier urge determinedly. "It's my turn now."
"Please don't,"
begged the drunken lady.
"Please don't."
At the very next corner, deep inside the dense, impenetrable shadows of a narrow, winding side street, he heard the mysterious, unmistakable sound of someone shoveling snow. The measured, labored, evocative scrape of iron shovel against concrete made his flesh crawl with terror,
as he stepped from the curb to cross the ominous alley and hurried onward until the haunting, incongruous noise had been left behind. Now he knew where he was. Soon, if he continued without turning, he would come to the dry fountain in the middle of the boulevard, then to the officer's apartment 7 blocks beyond. He heard snarling, inhuman voices cutting through the ghostly blackness in front suddenly. The bulb on the corner lamppost had died, spilling gloom over half the street, throwing everything visible off balance. On the other side of the intersection, a man was beating a dog with a stick, like the man who was beating the horse with a whip in Raskolnikov's dream. Yossarian strained helplessly not to see or hear. The dog whimpered and squealed in brute, dumbfounded hysteria at the end of an old manila rope, and groveled and crawled on its belly without resisting. But the man beat it and beat it anyway with his heavy, flat stick. A small crowd watched. A squat woman stepped out and asked him please to stop.
"Mind your own business,"
the man barked gruffly, lifting his stick as though he might beat her, too. And the woman retreated sheepishly, with an abject and humiliated air. Yossarian quickened his pace to get away, almost ran. The night was filled with horrors, and he thought he knew how Christ must have felt as he walked through the world, like a psychiatrist through a ward full of nuts, like a victim through a prison full of thieves. What a welcome sight a leper must have been. At the next corner, a man was beating a small boy brutally in the midst of an immobile crowd of adult spectators who made no effort to intervene. Yossarian recoiled with sickening recognition. He was certain he had witnessed that same horrible scene sometime before. Deja vu? The sinister coincidence shook him and filled him with doubt and dread. It was the same scene he had witnessed a block before, although everything in it seemed quite different. What in the world was happening? Would a squat woman step out and ask the man to please stop? Would he raise his hand to strike her and she would retreat? Nobody moved. The child cried steadily, as though in drugged misery. The man kept knocking him down with hard, resounding, open-palm blows to the head, then jerking him up to his feet in order to knock him down again. No one in the sullen, cowering crowd seemed to care enough about the stunned and beaten boy to interfere. The child was no more than 9. One drab woman was weeping silently into a dirty dish towel. The boy was emaciated and needed a haircut. Bright red blood was streaming from both ears. Yossarian crossed quickly to the other side of the immense avenue to escape the nauseating sight, and found himself walking on human teeth, lying on the drenched, glistening pavement near splotches of blood, kept sticky by the pelting raindrops, poking each one like sharp fingernails. Molars and broken incisors lay scattered everywhere. He circled on tiptoe the grotesque debris and came near a doorway containing a crying soldier holding a saturated handkerchief to his mouth, supported as he sagged by 2 other soldiers, waiting in grave impatience for the military ambulance that finally came clanging up with amber fog lights on and passed them by for an altercation on the next block between a single civilian Italian with books and a slew of civilian policemen with armlocks and clubs. The screaming, struggling civilian was a dark man with a face white as flour from fear. His eyes were pulsating in hectic desperation, flapping like bat's wings, as the many tall policemen seized him by the arms and legs and lifted him up. His books were spilled on the ground. "Help!" he shrieked shrilly in a voice strangling in its own emotion, as the policemen carried him to the open doors in the rear of the ambulance and threw him inside. "Police! Help! Police!" The doors were shut and bolted, and the ambulance raced away. There was a humorless irony in the ludicrous panic of the man screaming for help to the police, while policemen were all around him. Yossarian smiled wryly at the futile and ridiculous cry for aid, then saw with a start that the words were ambiguous, realized with alarm that they were not, perhaps, intended as a call for police, but as a heroic warning from the grave by a doomed friend. To everyone who is not a policeman with a club and a gun, and a mob of other policemen with clubs and guns to back him up.
"Help! Police!"
the man had cried, and it could have been shouting of danger. Yossarian responded to the thought by slipping away stealthily from the police, and almost tripped over the feet of a burly woman of 40, hastening across the intersection, guiltily, darting furtive, vindictive glances behind her toward a woman of 80, with thick, bandaged ankles doddering after her in a losing pursuit. The old woman was gasping for breath as she minced along, and muttering to herself in distracted agitation. There was no mistaking the nature of the scene. It was a chase. The triumphant first woman was halfway across the wide avenue before the second woman reached the curb. The nasty, small, gloating smile with which she glanced back at the laboring old woman was both wicked and apprehensive. Yossarian knew he could help the troubled old woman if she would only cry out, knew he could spring forward and capture the sturdy first woman and hold her for the mob of policemen nearby, if the second woman would only give him license with a shriek of distress. But the old woman passed by without even seeing him, mumbling in terrible, tragic vexation, and soon the first woman had vanished into the deepening layers of darkness, and the old woman was left standing helplessly in the center of the thoroughfare, dazed, uncertain which way to proceed, alone. Yossarian tore his eyes from her and hurried away in shame because he had done nothing to assist her. He darted furtive, guilty glances back as he fled in defeat, afraid the old woman might now start following him, and he welcomed the concealing shelter of the drizzling, drifting, lightless, nearly opaque gloom. Mobs, mobs of policemen. Everything but England was in the hands of mobs. Mobs, mobs, mobs with clubs were in control everywhere. The surface of the collar and shoulders of Yossarian's coat was soaked. His socks were wet and cold. The light on the next lamppost was out, too, the glass globe broken. Buildings and featureless shapes flowed by him noiselessly, as though borne past immutably on the surface of some rank and timeless tide. A tall monk passed, his face buried entirely inside a coarse gray cowl, even the eyes hidden. Footsteps sloshed toward him steadily through a puddle, and he feared it would be another barefoot child. He brushed by a gaunt, cadaverous, trustful man in a black raincoat with a star-shaped scar in his cheek and a glossy, mutilated depression the size of an egg in one temple. On squishing straw sandals, a young woman materialized, with her whole face disfigured by a god-awful pink and piebald burn that started on her neck and stretched in a raw, corrugated mass up both cheeks past her eyes. Yossarian could not bear to look, and shuddered. No one would ever love her. His spirit was sick. He longed to lie down with some girl he could love who would soothe and excite him and put him to sleep. A mob with a club was waiting for him in Pianosa. The girls were all gone. The countess and her daughter-in-law were no longer good enough. He had grown too old for fun. He no longer had the time. Luciana was gone. Dead, probably. If not yet, then soon enough. Arfi's buxom trollop had vanished with her smutty cameo ring, and Nurse Duckett was ashamed of him because he had refused to fly more combat missions and would cause a scandal. The only girl he knew nearby was the plain maid in the officer's apartment, whom none of the men had ever slept with. Her name was Michaela, but the men called her filthy things in dulcet, ingratiating voices, and she giggled with childish joy because she understood no English and thought they were flattering her and making harmless jokes.
Everything wild she watched them do filled her with enchanted delight. She was a happy, simple-minded, hard-working girl who could not read and was barely able to write her name. Her straight hair was the color of retting straw. She had sallow skin and myopic eyes, and none of the men had ever slept with her, because none of the men had ever wanted to. None but Arfi, who had raped her once that same evening, and had then held her prisoner in a clothes closet for almost 2 hours with his hand over her mouth, until the civilian curfew siren sounded and it was unlawful for her to be outside. Then he threw her out the window. Her dead body was still lying on the pavement when Yossarian arrived and pushed his way politely through the circle of solemn neighbors with dim lanterns who glared with venom as they shrank away from him and pointed up bitterly toward the second-floor windows in their private, grim, accusing conversations. Yossarian's heart pounded with fright and horror at the pitiful, ominous, gory spectacle of the broken corpse. He ducked into the hallway and bolted up the stairs into the apartment, where he found Arfi pacing about uneasily, with a pompous, slightly uncomfortable smile. Arfi seemed a bit unsettled as he fidgeted with his pipe and assured Yossarian that everything was going to be all right. There was nothing to worry about. "I only raped her once," he explained. Yossarian was aghast.
"But you killed her, Arfi? You killed her!"
"Oh, I had to do that after I raped her," Arfi replied in his most condescending manner. "I couldn't very well let her go around saying bad things about us, could I?"
"But why did you have to touch her at all, you dumb bastard?"
Yossarian shouted.
"Why couldn't you get yourself a girl off the street if you wanted one? The city is full of prostitutes!"
"Oh, no, not me," Arfi bragged. "I never paid for it in my life."
"Arfi, are you insane?"
Yossarian was almost speechless.
"You killed a girl. They're going to put you in jail."
"Oh, no," Arfi answered with a forced smile. "Not me. They aren't going to put good old Arfi in jail. Not for killing her."
"But you threw her out the window. She's lying there dead in the street."
"She has no right to be there," Arfi answered. "It's after curfew."
"Stupid! Don't you realize what you've done?"
Yossarian wanted to grab Arfi by his well-fed, caterpillar-soft shoulders and shake some sense into him.
"You've murdered a human being. They are going to put you in jail. They might even hang you."
"Oh, I hardly think they'll do that," Arfi replied with a jovial chuckle, although his symptoms of nervousness increased. He spilled tobacco crumbs unconsciously as his short fingers fumbled with the bowl of his pipe. "No, siree, that's a good old Arfi," he chortled again. "She was only a servant girl. I hardly think they're going to make too much of a fuss over one poor Italian servant girl when so many thousands of lives are being lost every day. Do you?"
"Listen,"
Yossarian cried, almost in joy. He pricked up his ears and watched the blood drain from Arfi's face as sirens mourned far away. Police sirens. And then ascended almost instantaneously to a howling, strident, onrushing cacophony of overwhelming sound that seemed to crash into the room around them from every side.
"Arfi, they're coming for you,"
he said in a flood of compassion, shouting to be heard above the noise.
"They're coming to arrest you. Arfi, don't you understand? You can't take the life of another human being and get away with it, even if she is just a poor servant girl. Don't you see? Can't you understand?"
"Oh, no," Arfi insisted with a lame laugh and a weak smile. "They're not coming to arrest me. Not good old Arfi." All at once he looked sick. He sank down on a chair in a trembling stupor, his stumpy, lax hands quaking in his lap. Cars skidded to a stop outside. Spotlights hit the windows immediately. Car doors slammed and police whistles screeched. Voices rose harshly. Arfi was green. He kept shaking his head mechanically with a queer, numb smile and repeating in a weak, hollow monotone that they were not coming for him, not for good old Arfi, no siree. Striving to convince himself that this was so, even as heavy footsteps raced up the stairs and pounded across the landing, even as fists beat on the door four times with a deafening, inexorable force. Then the door to the apartment flew open, and two large, tough, brawny MPs with icy eyes and firm, sinewy, unsmiling jaws entered quickly, strode across the room, and arrested Yossarian. They arrested Yossarian for being in Rome without a pass. They apologized to Arfi for intruding and led Yossarian away between them, gripping him under each arm with fingers as hard as steel manacles. They said nothing at all to him on the way down. Two more tall MPs with clubs and hard white helmets were waiting outside at a closed car. They marched Yossarian into the back seat, and the car roared away and weaved through the rain and muddy fog to a police station. The MPs locked him up for the night in a cell with four stone walls. At dawn, they gave him a pail for a latrine and drove him to the airport, where two more giant MPs with clubs and white helmets were waiting at a transport plane, whose engines were already warming up when they arrived, the cylindrical green cowlings oozing quivering beads of condensation. None of the MPs said anything to each other. They did not even nod. Yossarian had never seen such granite faces. The plane flew to Pianosa. Two more silent MPs were waiting at the landing strip. There were now eight, and they filed with precise wordless discipline into two cars and sped on humming tires past the four squadron areas to the group headquarters building, where still two more MPs were waiting at the parking area. All 10 tall, strong, purposeful, silent men towered around him as they turned toward the entrance. Their footsteps crunched in loud unison on the cindered ground. He had the impression of accelerating haste. He was terrified. Every one of the 10 MPs seemed powerful enough to bash him to death with a single blow. They had only to press their massive, toughened, boulderish shoulders against him to crush all life from his body. There was nothing he could do to save himself. He could not even see which two were gripping him under the arms as they marched him rapidly between the two tight single-file columns they had formed. Their pace quickened, and he felt as though he were flying along with his feet off the ground as they trotted in resolute cadence up the wide marble staircase to the upper landing, where still two more inscrutable military policemen with hard faces were waiting to lead them all at an even faster pace down the long cantilevered balcony overhanging the immense lobby. Their marching footsteps on the dull tile floor thundered like an awesome, quickening drum roll through the vacant center of the building, as they moved with even greater speed and precision toward Colonel Cathcart's office. And violent winds of panic began blowing in Yossarian's ears when they turned him toward his doom inside the office, where Colonel Korn, his rump spreading comfortably on a corner of Colonel Cathcart's desk, sat waiting to greet him with a genial smile, and said, "We're sending you home." Catch 22. There was, of course, a catch.
Catch 22? Inquired Yossarian.
Of course, Colonel Korn answered pleasantly after he had chased the mighty guard of massive MPs out with an insouciant flick of his hand and a slightly contemptuous nod, most relaxed as always when he could be most cynical. His rimless square eyeglasses glinted with sly amusement as he gazed at Yossarian.
After all, we can't simply send you home for refusing to fly more missions and keep the rest of the men here, can we? That would hardly be fair to them.
You're goddamn right,
Colonel Cathcart blurted out, lumbering back and forth gracelessly like a winded bull, puffing and pouting angrily.
I'd like to tie him up hand and foot and throw him aboard a plane on every mission. That's what I'd like to do.
Colonel Korn motioned Colonel Cathcart to be silent and smiled at Yusarian.
You know, you really have been making things terribly difficult for Colonel Cathcart,
he observed with flip good humor, as though the fact did not displease him at all.
The men are unhappy, and morale is beginning to deteriorate, and it's all your fault.
It's your fault, Yusarian argued, for raising the number of missions.
No, it's your fault for refusing to fly them, Colonel Korn retorted. The men were perfectly content to fly as many missions as we asked, as long as they thought they had no alternative. Now you've given them hope, and they're unhappy. So the blame is all yours.
Doesn't he know there's a war going on?
Colonel Cathcart, still stamping back and forth, demanded morosely without looking at Yusarian.
I'm quite sure he does, Colonel Korn answered. That's probably why he refuses to fly them.
Doesn't it make any difference to him?
Will the knowledge that there's a war going on weaken your decision to refuse to participate in it?
Colonel Korn inquired with sarcastic seriousness, mocking Colonel Cathcart.
No, sir,
Yusarian replied, almost returning Colonel Korn's smile.
I was afraid of that,
Colonel Korn remarked with an elaborate sigh, locking his fingers together comfortably on top of his smooth, bald, broad, shiny brown head.
You know, in all fairness, we really haven't treated you too badly, have we? We've fed you and paid you on time. We gave you a medal and even made you a captain.
I should never have made him a captain, Colonel Cathcart exclaimed bitterly. I should have given him a court-martial after he loused up that Ferrara mission and went around twice.
I told you not to promote him, said Colonel Korn, but you wouldn't listen to me.
No, you didn't. You told me to promote him, didn't you?
I told you not to promote him, but you just wouldn't listen.
I should have listened.
You never listen to me, Colonel Korn persisted with relish. That's the reason we're in this spot.
All right, gee whiz, stop rubbing it in, will you?
Colonel Cathcart burrowed his fists down deep inside his pockets and turned away in a slouch.
Instead of picking on me, why don't you figure out what we're going to do about him?
We're going to send him home, I'm afraid.
Colonel Korn was chuckling triumphantly when he turned away from Colonel Cathcart to face Yusarian.
Yusarian, the war is over for you. We're going to send you home. You really don't deserve it, you know, which is one of the reasons I don't mind doing it. Since there's nothing else we can risk doing to you at this time, we've decided to return you to the States. We worked out this little deal to...
What kind of deal?
Yusarian demanded with defiant mistrust. Colonel Korn tossed his head back and laughed.
Oh, a thoroughly despicable deal. Make no mistake about that. It's absolutely revolting. But you'll accept it quickly enough.
Don't be too sure.
I haven't the slightest doubt you will, even though it stinks to high heaven. Oh, by the way, you haven't told any of the men you've refused to fly more missions, have you?
No, sir,
Yusarian answered promptly. Colonel Korn nodded approvingly.
That's good. I like the way you lie. You'll go far in this world, if you ever acquire some decent ambition.
Doesn't he know there's a war going on?
Colonel Cathcart yelled out suddenly and blew with vigorous disbelief into the open end of his cigarette holder.
I'm quite sure he does, Colonel Korn replied acidly, since you brought that identical point to his attention just a moment ago.
Colonel Korn frowned wearily for Yusarian's benefit, his eyes twinkling swarthily with sly and daring scorn. Gripping the edge of Colonel Cathcart's desk with both hands, he lifted his flaccid haunches far back on the corner to sit with both short legs dangling freely. His shoes kicked lightly against the yellow oak wood, his sludge-brown socks, garterless, collapsed in sagging circles below ankles that were surprisingly small and white.
"You know, Yusarian,"
he mused affably in a manner of casual reflection that seemed both derisive and sincere,
"I really do admire you a bit. You're an intelligent person of great moral character who has taken a very courageous stand. I'm an intelligent person with no moral character at all, so I'm in an ideal position to appreciate it.
These are very critical times.